Blog Talk Radio.
Proudly brings to you Politically Direct, and I am the professor, Fernando Uribe. I want to welcome you all here tonight, the 15th of March, the year 2018. And of course, as we continue to celebrate Women's History Month here, I definitely want to send a shout out to all the ladies making a difference each and every day, to those in the past, the ones doing it today, and of course, the ones working for the future. Of course, once again, I want to thank you all for listening here from wherever you are throughout the Garden City, and of course, throughout the good old U.S. of A. You can always write the show's inbox, folks. This is politicallydirectnj@yahoo.com. Again, if you have any questions or suggestions for future topics or guests, please write to the show, politicallydirectnj@yahoo.com. Don't forget to like the show on Facebook. We are definitely increasing with traffic and more likes, people sharing our content. It's great. I'm very, very grateful to all of you. So, folks, please continue doing that. And share when you can and tell all your friends to like Politically Direct on Facebook. Don't forget to follow the show on Instagram at Politically Direct NJ. You can also follow yours truly on Instagram at your_favorite_Fernando. And, of course, you can follow me on Twitter at Fernando Uribe Jr. Now, I do want to hear from you tonight, ladies and gentlemen, so do not be shy whatsoever. Call me toll-free, 818-572-8032. Once again, toll-free number this evening, 818-572-8032. And our toll-free number, again, is brought to you by Insider NJ. And don't forget to check out Insider NJ every single day, folks, by going to www.insidernj.com for the best coverage of the political scene throughout the state of New Jersey. Once you go on the website, folks, just sign up with your email there. You'll be able to get the morning intelligence briefing, all the top stories going on in the Garden State, courtesy of Insider NJ. As I said, the best political coverage anywhere in New Jersey. So don't forget to start your day with Insider NJ. Now, the opinions and views expressed tonight and every week on Politically Direct are mine and mine alone. They do not represent those of Insider NJ, the management, the journalists, or staff. Of course, folks, as hope you're having a wonderful week here, again, as March is quickly flying by here. Before you know it, it'll be April. Certainly a daylight savings time this past Sunday. It'll take a little bit getting used to, but I'll tell you, when it's 7 o'clock and it's still daylight, it's quite the sight to see. So definitely that tells us that spring is right around the corner, so hopefully we'll see some good weather soon enough. And folks, as I like to begin with every single week, well, folks, a little bit of a different thing. I know that this week with the governor releasing the potential budget for the next fiscal year, certainly the legislature, both chambers of the legislature, will have to ratify it and pass it before the end of the fiscal year, which ends on June the 30th. So Governor Murphy this week made a point to get that budget out, to shop it around, not just for the media, but also to sort of give the legislature an idea of what he's looking for as it pertains to what taxes he's going to be raising, what revenue he's looking to create to help the residents of New Jersey. And certainly that's between now and June when the budget gets passed, hopefully, which it has to be actually by the state constitution. It has to be passed. Otherwise, we'll have another sort of state shutdown like we did for a couple of days last summer. So hopefully we can avoid that in 2018. And, you know, certainly the mantra here is about raising money and about raising revenue. Well, I'll tell you right now, folks, and something that I'm really excited about, because this is definitely going to help raise revenue in New Jersey. But I'll tell you right now, next April, there will be definitely a lot of money coming in to the state of New Jersey, because you know what? And I'm very excited to announce, and it'll be official tomorrow morning, but, you know, buckle up, wrestling fans, because WrestleMania is coming back to New Jersey. Now, media outlets are reporting that the WWE World Wrestling Entertainment, which is headed by chairman and founder Vince McMahon, will announce that WrestleMania 35 will be hosted at MetLife Stadium in East Rutherford next year. Now, certainly sources that are confirming this are asking to not be identified, as they're not authorized to speak publicly on the matter. Now, the official notice will be made tomorrow morning at MetLife Stadium at 11 a.m. It's my understanding that Lieutenant Governor Sheila Oliver will be joined by New York Giants President John Mara, which, let's be honest, I mean, next spring or even this spring, there really isn't anything going on at MetLife, so I'm sure he's very happy to have anything really of entertainment value there. And, of course, also New York Jets President Neil Glatt as well will be both present at the announcement with other yet-to-be-named guests, which I'm sure we'll see Vince McMahon and I'm certainly other officials with the WWE. Now, rumors have been circling for some time that the Super Bowl of professional wrestling would indeed be returning to the Garden State, and that rumor had been swirling around for many, many months. And apparently the report indicates that we could be looking at next April 2019, again at MetLife, we could be looking at April 7th, the first Sunday of April, normally is when WrestleMania takes place. Now, for all of you that perhaps are not wrestling fans, well, this will be the fourth WrestleMania in New Jersey. Now, the first two were WrestleManias 4 and 5, back-to-back, at the Boardwalk Hall in Atlantic City, both in 1988 and in 1989. Of course, those two events were promoted by then the president of the Trump Corporation, Donald J. Trump, who at the time owned a pair of casinos in Atlantic City, both Trump Plaza and the Trump Castle. Now, on TV, both events were said to have taken place, again, at the Trump Plaza. Even though that wasn't really the case, it took place at the Boardwalk Hall. Now, the last time that New Jersey hosted WrestleMania was in 2013, when MetLife Stadium served as the arena for WrestleMania 29. Now, folks, some really interesting facts here about WrestleMania 29 back in 2013. We had an attendance of over 80,000 fans packing MetLife Stadium. It was a really, really, really good event. But more importantly, folks, I think what really stands out about this event is the fact of the amount of money that it brought the New York, New Jersey area. Now, again, at the time, the WWE set at first a sales record of 52,000 tickets, easily beating the WrestleMania 18 record at the time in Toronto of 51,620 tickets. And of course, you know, as many statisticians would confirm, the WWE also set a first day revenue record of more than $10 million that day when selling tickets for WrestleMania 29. And of course, you know, that year, WrestleMania was streaming on mobile devices via the WWE app and, of course, also on Xbox Live. And one of the great things, folks, about WrestleMania that day in 2013 was that the WrestleMania set included replicas of, you know, many New York City landmarks, which include the Brooklyn Bridge, the Empire State Building, of course, on the entrance ramp, with the Statue of Liberty on a podium above the ring. And, of course, you know, it was a great, great event. Again, 80,676 fans packed into MetLife Stadium that very nice early spring day in April of 2013. And certainly this, you know, for me, living here and being a diehard pro wrestling fan, I'm super excited, not just because as a professional wrestling fan, but it really does a lot for the area. And when we talk about sporting events that bring money and revenue into a region that perhaps definitely needs it, folks, look no further. April, the New York City area is going to greatly benefit, especially here in New Jersey. It's going to greatly benefit from tourism, from revenue, from everything else that the Super Bowl professional wrestling brings. And it'll be quite an accomplishment, to say the least, folks, because, you know, looking at what estimates tell us right now, we could be looking at almost $100 million of revenue being poured into New Jersey and the New York City metropolitan area. And again, I can't say enough about for New Jersey, of course, to be on the grand stage, to be featured. And again, I can't say enough about what a wonderful opportunity this is going to be for the state of New Jersey next year when WrestleMania comes here for the 35th annual WrestleMania. I mean, it's amazing to me, 35 years of WrestleMania. Who would have thought it? When you think about the impact this is going to have, not just on pop culture, you're going to have celebrities, you're going to have social media accounts just on fire leading up to WrestleMania 35. But more importantly, folks, tourism, hospitality, restaurants, bars, merchandise sales, you name it, it's going to greatly benefit New Jersey. And of course, it's going to benefit New York City as well. And that's the great thing about bringing WrestleMania here to the Garden State. And next year, again, I can't be any happier to hear the news today that it'll be official tomorrow morning. I'm certainly going to be very excited. I'm saving my money right now. I'm going to say it right now. I'm going to start saving today for WrestleMania 35. But more importantly, folks, in a time when we're trying to think about how to raise revenue and what's going to benefit the area, I'll tell you, good job by Vince McMahon. Good job by Paul Levesque, the chief operation, you know, the chief operations officer for WWE, and of course the entire WWE, like, you know, empire, for looking at the New York, New Jersey area as sort of the pinnacle of being that capital of professional wrestling. Folks, 35 years ago, to the inaugural WrestleMania on March 31st, 1985. I mean, it was an idea that was unheard of in any sort of type of entertainment, and sure enough, you know, they broke records at Madison Square Garden that year in 1985. And who would have thought 35 years later, we're going to be looking at WrestleMania in the New York area once again. But more importantly, it's going to be here in New Jersey. And again, I'm excited. And more importantly, I'm happy for the area, for all of my friends that work in hospitality, that work in tourism, for friends of mine that, listen, driving Ubers, driving Lyfts, merchandise sales, everything else, it's going to greatly benefit the area. And if there was ever a region that needs an economic boost, it's certainly going to be New Jersey. And I'm excited to see that. And again, I'm looking forward to the announcement tomorrow morning at 11 a.m. at MetLife Stadium. And it's going to be quite the sight to just announce that coming up next April, WrestleMania 35 once again comes to New Jersey. I couldn't think of a better place. Well, actually, I could. Cowboy Stadium back in 2016. When they broke the all-time record of over 107,000 fans at Cowboy Stadium in Dallas. So, but I'll tell you, coming to New Jersey, I'm very excited, and I know that it's going to greatly benefit New Jersey. And as a lifelong resident, I'll tell you right now, I'm excited. And for all of you pro wrestling fans, and even if you're not a pro wrestling fan, guess what? There's going to be tons of things to do. There's going to be tons of appearances by professional wrestlers, both past and present, legends, great autograph sessions, great attractions all throughout the region. If you remember back in WrestleMania 29 in 2013, you had appearances, you had television, you had everything going on here in the area. You know, New York City and New Jersey were the capital of the world in 2013. And guess what? Coming up next year, it's going to be the same thing for the Super Bowl of professional wrestling. I'm excited. WrestleMania, here we come. And that, folks, is my first shot. All right, ladies and gentlemen, again, do me a favor. Call in tonight. I want to hear from you. 818-572-8032. The toll-free number tonight to call in. I want to hear from you tonight. We have a great guest coming up in just a moment. So certainly I'd love to hear from you tonight. Again, 818-572-8032 at our toll-free number is brought to you by Insider NJ. Again, don't forget to check out Insider NJ by going to www.insidernj.com for the best coverage of the political scene throughout the state of New Jersey, whether it was this budget announcement by Governor Murphy, certainly some of the interesting congressional districts up for grabs later this November. There's no shortage of things to talk about, folks. Certainly the pending war here in Hudson County as it pertains to the upcoming county executive election, some lines being drawn in the sand by very powerful forces in Hudson County. We're seeing some political battles in other counties throughout the state of New Jersey. And you know what? Nobody covers it better than Insider NJ. So again, www.insidernj.com for the best coverage you can always find. Again, sign up for the morning intelligence briefing. submit your email. Trust me, each and every morning, deliver to your inbox. So as you're having breakfast or starting your day, we're going to do so with Insider NJ. All right, folks, here are 15 minutes past the hour here on the East Coast, 15 minutes after 8. Again, for all of you tuning in tonight here on Blog Talk Radio, I want to thank you again for tuning in. A great time, as always, here on the network. And again, as I said, 818-572-8032, the number to call in tonight if you wish to opine about anything going on in New Jersey, certainly whether it's the pending legalization battle as it pertains to marijuana. I know that's been in the headlines this week as well. We'll certainly touch on that a little bit later in the program during my news rundown. And certainly some things that have attracted some attention and perhaps some, some backlash concerning the budget of Governor Phil Murphy. So it's certainly one that will, generate a lot of debate. And, it'll be very interesting to see along party lines what's going to happen with this upcoming budget. So, again, great job by Insider NJ this week to really highlight what this budget entails. And as I said at the onset of the program, it's going to be very interesting between now and June, ladies and gentlemen, as it pertains to how much this budget is going to get dissected, how much is going to get really sort of cut out this week as we're looking at a preliminary budget set forth by the governor. And again, we'll be looking to have some very interesting guests coming up in the next few weeks as it pertains to those in the legislature that will be voting for the budget or against the budget. We'll find out. And it has, without a doubt, generated a lot of discussion online, on social media, certainly, along the lines of, trying to give feedback as it pertains to this. But, and really, what's the best way to sort of raise revenue in New Jersey? And, of course, no one likes to get their taxes raised, and certainly that was one of the concerns concerning Governor Murphy once he took office. So I have to say that it's going to be something that will be worth keeping an eye on again as his term continues. And really, folks, he's only been in office maybe a little under 2 months. So I think that throughout the state, I know the governor has been facing some scrutiny and some backlash, even throughout from his own party. So we'll find out certainly what will entail with that. Certainly, I know that gun control is a very important measure and initiative by the governor. I know he's taking it upon himself and, of course, working with members of the legislature and other advocacy groups as well to really, get out there. And, some would argue, I know that a couple of weeks ago I had a gun rights advocate, a good buddy of mine by the name of Anthony Calandro, representing Gun for Hire, and it was a really, really productive discussion as it pertained to looking at gun rights and what the city of New Jersey could be doing better for, law-abiding citizens, for example. We know that certainly now the climate is ripe to talk about gun rights and possible gun reform. And certainly we'll see what will be going on with that. And speaking of which, here, it's great 18 minutes past 8 here on the East Coast. It's my pleasure to bring you here on Politically Direct my guest this week, the lovely Dolores Phillips, the legislative director representing Ceasefire NJ. Dolores, how are you? Welcome to Politically Direct.
Hi, thank you for having me on.
Appreciate it. Thank you so much for your valuable time today, Dolores. And, one of the things I had a chance to do, as I like to do every single week here on the show, is certainly I like to do my homework on my guests and certainly do my homework on the organizations that they represent. And I know that Ceasefire NJ is quite the reputable organization here in New Jersey in terms of what they're advocating for. And we know that the political climate concerning gun reform, gun rights, has been a very delicate one in recent weeks, if not months, if not years, due to the abundance of shootings taking place here on our soil. And you're a great guest to have on tonight. And I want, for our listeners that are not aware of what Ceasefire NJ does and what they represent, could you tell us a little bit more about what this organization stands for?
Yes. Ceasefire New Jersey is the oldest gun violence prevention organization in New Jersey. And the goal is simply that, gun violence prevention. at this point, our goal has been through meeting that goal has been through education, and legislation on the statewide level, and also on the federal level, but primarily the state.
Well, one of the things, Dolores, that again, this topic is one that has been in the news cycle for some time. Certainly, the tragic events taking place in Parkland, Florida, a couple of weeks back, highlight the emotion that surrounds this topic. Of course, we've had other shootings in recent months and years under different circumstances. We know that Governor Murphy, certainly his position, is probably slightly different, I think, to be fair, than his predecessor as it pertains to looking at gun rights and any possible gun reform. From your experience, again, since you are the legislative director, certainly you're in Trenton often, you're working with members of the legislature. Perhaps some in New Jersey, Dolores, would argue, especially law-abiding citizens, especially those that want to obtain a firearm legally, for example, that the process is quite laborious and sometimes overly, not invasive, but overly lengthy. And that could be a problem for law-abiding citizens. Is that something that you've heard in terms of a backlash when it comes to this sort of issue?
I have heard that from some individuals who actually are friends who live in Pennsylvania and who attempted to obtain a gun permit in New Jersey. He did complete it. He went through the necessary checks and balances, and now has a permit in both states. But I think our position, you know, on this is that at this point, if it takes a little bit longer to obtain a gun, and that possibly slows somebody down who might be considering suicide, which is also part of this issue, might be somebody that might be in a rage over, let's say, even a marital squabble, because domestic violence is also a significant part of the gun violence prevention discussion. If that slows somebody down and we help to prevent deaths or violence that might end up with somebody with severe injuries, then I think that's for the best.
Well, Dolores, listen, I'm all for sensible gun reform. I'm all for example, sensible gun laws. And I think that no one can argue how, you know, rational that is, and certainly how practical that is, and also commonsensical, as I said. And I know that some of the bills that Governor Murphy was looking to sign into law, which I believe he did, represent for many advocates some of the strict gun control measures that the state has ever seen. I know that there are many gun rights advocates in New Jersey that went to Trenton recently. A good friend of mine who was on the show a couple of weeks ago, who owns a gun range, was one of those that went to Trenton and speak to members of the assembly. Again, you're in Trenton often, so maybe you can tell me whether I'm right or wrong on this perception, but it seems like many in the assembly during the hearings weren't very receptive to gun rights owners and advocates. Is that something that maybe you've seen firsthand, or is it just something that it just depends on perception?
I think there's a lot of emotion on both sides of the issue. I was also at the hearing, and I sat there for the entire 6 hours, as did all the members of the legislature that were on the committee. But they can speak for themselves. I can tell you what I saw and what my sense was. I also took down, I know shorthand, and I took down copious notes from all the testimony on both sides as a way to also try and understand better why we can't have a conversation about this. I think part of the, I did want to say that I heard your friend's testimony. In fact, it's in my notes, and I just went over it again today. And I do know that after he testified, that one of the reasons that particular bill that he was concerned about was held and moved into the Appropriations Committee, which is a way of slowing the bill down so that it can be worked on, is because they were concerned about his comments. So, you know, from my, there were, when we started off, there were six pieces of legislation in that committee that were being considered. And these are bills that the Assembly Majority Leader had introduced many years ago. And because of the governor's sentiment at that time, which was Governor Christie, the bills really were not moved. With the advent of, you know, the recent mass shootings, Parkland only being one of those, and I think you probably remember the Las Vegas shooting and then the Charleston yeah. shooting, and as we know, the list has gotten longer and longer, that I think anybody that is in a policymaking capacity, you know, representing citizens, have to look at the problem and start to do something. A majority of these bills actually close loopholes. I've been through every one of them. Some might need some tweaking here and there, and it is one of the reasons that you have a hearing. And 6 hours of testimony is, I haven't sat, honestly, after all the years I've spent in Trenton, I haven't heard too many. I haven't been part of too many hearings that have lasted that long, even on the most emotional of issues, which is on animal rights issues. And in that case, it was on hunting and the leghold trap, and which had not been banned yet at that point. And as vociferous as that was, in fact, the glass had, there was window glass that actually had broken in the chambers from the foot stomping from hunters that attended the meeting. I've never heard, saw the patience that I saw and the discipline with the members of the legislature that sat through 6 hours, who did not engage in argument, but asked. They did ask questions. Did they ask a lot of questions? No. But what they were trying to do is get out probably before midnight, because they wanted everybody to be able to have a voice. If you signed up to testify on all six of the bills, you were given permission to testify on all six, no matter what you had previously said before. My point is that your friend actually, who runs the range, had a legitimate problem, and that particular bill was on the size of the clip, or also, you know, called magazine, and that he had that it held 15 bullets, and the legislation was going to require that be limited to 10. For a particular reason, and I can tell you what that is if you want to hear it. But he was heard, he was asked questions, and the bill is being discussed and being worked on. I do not know if he's involved with that. I have not been involved with it, but I hope that he had legitimate concerns, which was the number of these clips that he had at his firing range for people that came to practice shooting.
Well, it's interesting, and folks, again, if you're just joining us now, you're 30 minutes past 8 here on the East Coast. It's, again, my pleasure to have Mr. Lawrence Phillips, the legislative director representing Ceasefire NJ here on the program. And honestly, Dolores, you know, I appreciate you giving me that clarity because I think it's important for our listeners to understand how lengthy a process like this can be, and certainly sitting there for the amount of hours you just described for hearings can be draining, and certainly it can be exhausting. And I appreciate you sort of breaking that down here for us tonight. A couple of things I want to get your thoughts. You mentioned you took extensive notes that day, and I know that the bills that Governor Murphy has intended to sign, if not signed already, a couple, again, for our listeners tonight, just to be aware, they go as follows. The bill A-2761 would reduce the maximum capacity of ammunition magazines, as you mentioned, to 10 rounds. A-2758 would codify regulations defining justifiable need to carry a handgun. A-2757 would require background checks for private gun sales. A-2759 will prohibit possession of ammunition capable of penetrating body armor. And the last one, A-2760, would revise definition of destructive device to include certain weapons of 50 caliber or greater. Of these bills, Dolores, and I know you took extensive notes, which is the one you probably looked at as probably the most promising?
There also were other, there were two other bills that were on,
okay,
heard in that committee that day. One of them, which actually is quite important, I know to the sponsor, but to many activists who are concerned about this issue, particularly in cases of domestic violence, in cases of rage. And I mentioned rage particularly because I have personally experienced that in family situations where there has been domestic violence, and I think it's one of the areas that if you fully are not in control of yourself and in a rage, anything can happen. And that is one of the points of this legislation is it is called the red flag bill. But in the situation down in Parkland at the high school, there were a number of people who saw that, as we all have probably know by now, who have seen some odd behavior, knew that he had a particular type of assault gun, knew that he, you know, was having mental health issues, could he have been stopped? And if this particular law we're working on now, I believe it's only currently in 5 states. If it were into place, his mother, a student, a teacher, a counselor would be able to call the police. They would then intervene. They would take the gun away, and there would be a waiting period and, of course, counseling, whatever intervention would actually be needed. Governor Murphy mentioned it the other day during his budget speech. He's quite aware of this bill. There are many gun violence prevention organizations throughout the nation and in New Jersey working on this in particular. So if there is a problem that it makes it easier essentially to report somebody and to hopefully get help as soon as possible.
Okay, all right.
That
well,
bill number was A. I'm sorry. I'm just going to give you the bill number. It was A1217.
Okay. Okay. Well, and again, and I'm glad you illustrate that for us tonight, because I think it's important to really get a concise understanding of these bills and certainly what they mean here in New Jersey, where, I mean, many would argue that New Jersey has had some of the strictest gun laws in the country. It just got a little more strict now for those that perhaps are looking to purchase a weapon. One of the things, Dolores, that's always, I hate to use the word interesting because it's not meant to be entertaining, but one of the things that always dominates the narrative about the discussion as it pertains to gun reform or sensible gun laws or even, you know, gun control, for example, tends to always, you know, surround itself with politics. And more times than not, ideology starts to sort of, you know, get involved with how we perceive gun ownership and how we perceive gun rights. I know I was, you know, I was talking to my students in one of my courses I teach, my intro class in sociology, and my students were asking me shortly after the Parkland incident. They said, Dr. Uribe, you know, one of the things that really scares me is, you know, whether it's at a college campus like this or any school, like, you know, what safety do we have? And I know that whether it's in the state of Florida or other states, there seems to be sort of like a very growing movement about having more armed personnel in our schools. And I think no one would argue that that's not a good idea, for example. I know the president has gone on to say on record that even suggesting that perhaps teachers should be armed in our schools or our college campuses because it'll make the environment safer. When you hear that sort of narrative or rhetoric, is it something that's just tends to always just be political, or is it just something more, you know, of a personal individual view?
It may be both. Yes, we have been watching the response to this very carefully. I think organizationally, most, and I think most activists that are working on a nonviolent approach to this problem would say no more guns. I am not an expert on in-school safety, but I have also watched this horrified and have wondered how would I feel if I had children in there? How would I feel if I was the child myself in there? I was raised during a period where during the Cold War, we had to practice getting under our desks, because I was raised in the military. My dad was career Air Force, and we had to worry about bomb shelters and being scared all the time about a bomb hitting us. And I can imagine the horror that everybody has felt in these schools, and in fact, not just the schools, but also at the concerts, also at the Charleston AME Church during the Bible study. And, you know, you always felt that you could be safe someplace. And, you know, school is scary enough when you're a kid, even
absolutely,
in high school.
Yeah. Absolutely.
You know, and to have to worry about this on top of this is very troubling. But, no, I do not. I think that's a response that I wish the president didn't say that. I wish that he would have deliberated more on this before we have a pat response that the answer to gun violence is more guns, because I do not think the data bears that out. We do know my background is in public health, and, you know, we do know that we have a public health crisis now on this, and we need to look at the problem, gather, you know, excuse me for saying the word, but data on the problem and what is going to be the solution. I think, yes, I do think that the stricter gun laws, that will close loopholes, slow people down that might be in a rage or have mental health problems or for other reasons are really important. But I do not think the answer is to give someone a loaded gun in high school. And I don't think that a teacher should have to worry about that.
Okay, fair enough. And folks, again, if you're just joining us here, 40 minutes past the hour here on the East Coast, it's my pleasure again to have you on the program, Ms. Dolores Phillips. She is the legislative director for Ceasefire New Jersey here on Politically Direct. Dolores, one of the things that really dominates the narrative for some time, not just with the Parkland, Florida incident, but for some time, has been, again, as I mentioned a few moments ago, looking at this through political lens. And
yes.
I'll just state an opinion. I certainly don't want to speak for you, but I would just say that a lot of what's been going on for many, many months, if not years, certainly has been politicized. And one of the things that a colleague of mine brought this to my attention recently, and he said to me, he's an NRA member, and he said, you know, Fernando, we were in the faculty lounge, and he was like, hey, Fernando, you know, I don't get something. And he asked me this, and I really didn't have an answer. You know, and I'm normally very quick on my feet. And he said to me, he goes, you know, Fernando, you know, not one shooter in recent memory, like whether it's in Parkland or in Las Vegas or other schools, like not one mass shooter is an NRA member. And he's someone who tends to sort of lean conservative. And he said to me, you know, not one shooter we've seen in recent memory, if ever at all, is an NRA member. But ideologically, many liberals in the country insist on calling the NRA a terrorist organization. And then he says to me, you know, but when an Islamic terrorist, pleads allegiance to Islam, for example, and commits an act of violence, you know, ideologically, many liberals in the country will say, oh, well, wait a minute, that has nothing to do with Islam. Is there a disconnect there, maybe sometimes, or maybe a disingenuous nature about how politics works itself into this discussion when it comes to looking at gun reform or even the NRA, for example?
Yes. Is there a disconnect? I think that politics in itself and the egos involved always cause disconnections. And as I had mentioned earlier, I think one of the, very difficult situations on discussing, gun violence prevention is are the emotions on both sides. When you're highly emotional, you can't have a rational discussion. Can one, just look at the facts? And, you know, this is particularly gets harder for legislators. But as we know, a legislator often, and I'm just going to talk about the state legislature right now, because this is a New Jersey show coming out of New Jersey, is, a legislator can feel a particular way, look at the facts, but they also have to, take the time, or the staff has to take the time to look into the problem. We have a part-time legislature here in New Jersey, although their presence more than in many other states, Pennsylvania being a good example, because I have been to Harrisburg, and as you know, they don't meet for very long during the year at all. It's extremely difficult to do policy in that state, from my perspective at least. So you have legislators that many are working full-time jobs. I respond to their constituents in a state that, has the second highest population density. Well, I think it's number one population density per square mile in the nation.
Yes.
With a variety of types of people. And, in any legislature, there is the individual legislator. Do they respond to their district and their constituents? Do they respond to their majority leader? Do they respond to, you know, others putting pressure on them from within the legislature itself? I have, you know, witnessed all types of reasons for votes that sometimes come down to simply trading votes for a particular committee on a completely different issue. So right now, I think NRA is being focused on, you saw this, you know, in particular with the high school students that, you know, came out right away on this. I think one of the reasons for that, and I'm speaking from, here's the perspective I'm speaking from, you know, I'm not talking completely organizationally now, but I have to tell you that I was raised in a family where my father did have guns and was a Pennsylvania hunter and, you know, was a combat veteran from World War II, you know, that did have shotguns in the basement and was actually raised to learn how to shoot. But he also was an NRA member, and I did see the literature that came to the house. And I will tell you this, they do have a tendency to turn up the heat. And I have seen footage from their conferences. I did watch the president right after of the organization, Mr. LaPierre. Do I have that correct? Do not want to say his name wrong.
No, that is correct, yeah.
Yes, and it does not feel that they are willing to have a discussion. He was very clear, the president of the organization, right after Parkland, that the teachers needed to arm themselves and that the answer was more guns. I watched this, you know, from live video footage, and I'm assuming that that was honest footage on the news. I think that they perhaps do themselves a disservice by turning up the temperature. I think they had a particular goal when they were first created, and I think the organization has become very different since that time. And I do understand, you know, the role that they've had historically teaching gun safety. But I think we have to look at what is their role today. Where is so much of the money that they are, why are they distributing such large sums of money to a number of members of Congress? That's public record. Why?
Well, that's a good question, and certainly it is one that is being debated on in many different arenas, both in the mainstream media, certainly on social media, certainly in pop culture. I think it's that's a talking point. I know that has been brought up considerably about the type of influence that the NRA exerts on our political process and also our legislative process, Dolores. So. Listen, I hear what you're saying in the sense of how you're trying to describe not just the historical component of the NRA, but certainly to its present day, what they're doing. And something I wanted to ask you, again, as someone who certainly works with the legislature here in New Jersey and one that is, you know, very much an advocate for – well, let me put it this way. For our audience today, so there's no ambiguity, you're for – commonsensical, reasonable gun, right? I mean, I think we're on the same page where we're for common sense gun laws, correct? I think we can agree on that, right?
Yes.
Okay. Now, working with the legislature like you do in your present position, something that comes up quite often, maybe obviously not in Trenton, but with the narrative even on a national scene, is it something that is worth exploring as it pertains to the way the Second Amendment is worded? I know that court case after court case has created this debate about how the Second Amendment reads. Now, I don't have a law degree, and nor am I a constitutional scholar, but I'm sure that we could take 10 people and read that amendment verbatim, and perhaps all 10 people might have a different understanding or reaction to how they read it. Is we're living in a climate now, for example, politically, that revisiting the Second Amendment is something worth doing? Or is it more about, we can leave the Second Amendment intact, but it's more about creating laws that make sense as it pertains to, you know, background checks, mental health initiatives? What would you say?
You are correct about that. If we did get 10 people in a room, everybody probably would have a different reading on it. And I am not a constitutional scholar either. I have read it. I have thought about it. I read lots of legislation. So I also have a tendency to read that and also understand the history behind it, because I've read colonial history extensively, and you know, I have been to Concord, Massachusetts, and I have stood on that bridge, and it's a different time. It should it be revisited? I think. I'd like to see, you know, the ERA amendment, you know, on the Constitution. But we all know that constitutional changes are going to be very difficult to make. I do know that, yes, there have been lawsuits. There were lawsuits threatened at the hearing here in New Jersey 2 weeks ago, simply because the legislature was putting up these pieces of legislation. I also wanted to say that a number of people that testified were also extremely insulting to the legislature because they were putting these up. It was a little hot and testy in the room for a while. But back to that Second Amendment, I think it needs to be looked at very closely and perhaps not thrown in everybody's face when there are laws being worked on to address the problems that we're facing today. It's a very different time, just like the climate is different and the traffic is different and how we work is different. And so, you know, perhaps it does need to be. I don't know when that would happen. It's not anything that we are advocating for, but I think that utilizing it as a reason to do what you want with a gun or to carry a loaded weapon concealed and be able to go from state to state and supersede those laws, it's not appropriate.
Okay. Interesting. And something I sort of want to throw out there for you, because I know that especially not just even statewide, and I'm sure that during those 6 hours it became very contentious, like anything else. You're anywhere for 6 hours debating something, it's going to get exhausting, and as you mentioned, certainly tempers may flare. Thankfully, it remained civil, from my understanding. I mean, I could be wrong in terms of people eyewitness accounts.
We got through without any screaming or fighting or punch. You know, punching people
sure.
out.
Well, I mean, it certainly didn't become WWE, thank goodness, and it remained civil, thankfully, when it came to trying to address these bills and address, you know, the concerns of the legislature also and these advocates. You know, one thing, Dolores, that is interesting, I know that comes up a lot in sort of in the political discourse about common sense gun laws, about gun reform, about looking at gun rights, and what tends to sort of happen quite often politically is this idea where, well, let's look at other areas of the country where we see strict gun control and look what happens. And I'm sure you've read reports and I'm sure you've read the literature that's been brought to your attention. You know, more times than not, politically, we tend to hear, hey, look at that hellhole in Illinois. Look at Chicago. I mean, that place is a nightmare. It's a hellhole. It's the abyss, possibly, of civilization, perhaps. And we're seeing a rampant amount of gun violence there in that city. And I think it's argued that Chicago has perhaps, maybe next to New Jersey and New York, maybe even Connecticut, the city of Chicago has the strictest gun laws perhaps in the country. And we're seeing a consistent amount of gun violence and gun deaths taking place monthly in Chicago. Now, whether or not the media reports on it, I mean, we could sit here all day and dissect the agenda of the mainstream media. But when we think about regions of the country where there are strict gun laws and we're still seeing a very consistent rise in gun violence, does the correlation become a little weakened, you think, in terms of, you know, what's the right narrative to sort of put forward?
Not necessarily. I think this problem is multifaceted, and that certainly is an understatement. But my belief is that this needs to be approached not only with what you can do, first of all, with tightening up the gun laws, but then you need to be able to enforce those laws. Let us not forget that aspect of it and the funding that it takes to actually enforce those laws. Because a law is a law and a regulation is a regulation, but if you don't have enforcement, it's all rather meaningless. It's just words on paper. So that's number one. Number two is that this is a public health crisis. The data, you know, when you look at the numbers now, this is the numbers are now high enough that this needs to be looked at from a public health approach, and it needs to be answers that need to come for it need to be deliberated on and looked at on from that multifaceted, multi-pronged approach. I am not trying to weasel out of the question, but I think that Chicago, and I am very familiar with what's happening there, and in fact, this topic was on NPR today, where they interviewed one of the high schoolers who walked out during the remembrance protest that occurred today. He was from Chicago, and he was very used to gun violence. And in fact, his nephew had been killed in street gun violence. I'm not far from the city of Trenton here, where there are an escalation of murders, and you probably do not even hear about them very much. I know you probably worked in Trenton a little bit, and I you can simply look at the newspapers and or the whatever press comes out on it, and you do not hear about these murders and the street violence. And yes, a lot of the guns are coming in illegally. It's one of the reasons why I like Governor Murphy's idea about the corridor that will actually take place. Right now, there are the states from Delaware going up to Massachusetts. The governors are going to be looking at this from more of a regional approach, try and stop some of this gun running. As you know, there was just recently an arrest that occurred in New Jersey about gun running that was coming from Ohio that had assault weapons. They were running assault weapons into the state. And I'm probably saying this very simplistically, but I don't think the fact that there are tight gun laws and gun violence is high simultaneously in a place like Chicago is a reason to abandoning changing gun legislation reform or gun violence prevention, as we call it.
Okay, understood. And folks here, again, if you're just joining us here, it's 9 o'clock on the East Coast here on Politically Direct. It's my pleasure again to have on the program Mr. Lawrence Phillips, the legislative director for Ceasefire NJ, nonprofit here in New Jersey. Dolores, one of the things, and I'm glad you sort of broke that down for us tonight. I think it's important to really sort of get an overall understanding. Getting back to one of the things in the bills that were presented in the assembly, and I know you were there taking extensive notes, and I just want to get your thoughts on it. Again, a lot of the parameters that I read as it pertains to the Bills, I think are very commonsensical. One that did stand out for me, and one that, again, I have the bill in front of me here. I'm looking at the PDF. It's kind of long, so I did look at it before, but it's kind of lengthy. You know, one of the provisions that was, I think, maybe a red flag for gun rights advocates was, quote, making people seek a handgun permit under, quote, justifiable need, demonstrating the urgent necessity for the firearm rather than a more generalized fear or concern. You know, I'm someone, for example, that has been trying to go through the process of obtaining a firearm for security and protection because it's my right to do so. And one of the things that looking at this language, I think it's difficult to sort of argue the fact that some residents in New Jersey might say, well, you know, who's going to quantify justifiable need, the legislature or myself? Like, who's going to quantify how safe I feel, the legislature or me? And I think for a lot of residents, again, I'm not going to speak for people, Dolores. I'm only going to speak for myself. But if someone's going to ask me, well, Fernando, why would you go through the process of getting fingerprints? Why would you go through the process of, filling out the application, getting the reference letters, going through the entire process? What's the need? And I would say, well, for safety purposes, I mean, I don't live in a particularly dangerous area. I think where I live in Union City is perhaps one of the better policed municipalities in all of New Jersey. And I thank my mayor and state senator for that. But like anybody else, I would just, if asked, I would say, well, it's my right to do so. And if I go through the proper channels and I know that I'll pass the background check, I'll pass the mental health check, I'll pass everything, that, I should be able to obtain it. Not as quickly as possible, but within a reasonable amount of time. Based on that language in that bill, some residents might say, well, wait a minute, who's going to quantify justifiable need? Like, who's in charge of my safety? Am I or the legislature? Who's going to tell me whether or not I feel safe? What would you tell residents that maybe have that concern when they read that language in one of the bills?
The justifiable need for a handgun, and I think it's important that you make it clear that you were going to purchase a handgun, correct? The bar is higher for handguns, mostly because they are it's easy enough to conceal them. The justifiable need legislation, again, it was legislation this issue was not addressed significantly before it was brought up this time around. If you recall, in 2016, Governor Christie had attempted to circumvent the legislature, who was working on this issue at the time, by issuing an executive order. And the bottom line is, after working on legislation and regulation to attempt to define what is a justifiable need, my understanding around a lot of this debate, and it is a debate, and I think that your concerns are valid, that the justifiable need is also being determined by law enforcement. And recommendations that they are making from experiences that they have had.
Well, based on that, Dolores, then I think, I don't want to speak for residents in New Jersey. I mean, again, our listeners can make their own mind on their own. But if we're going to rely on law enforcement, is there a possibility, or perhaps not a danger, but is there the possibility where the legislature, the law enforcement in New Jersey might sort of just take it upon themselves and say, well, we're going to be the judge and jury here, and we're going to be the ones that You know, residents should trust us more. And again, I can't speak for everybody in New Jersey, but I think a lot of residents would say, well, I don't know if I want to trust my police department in Trenton or Camden, Elizabeth or Newark, where, you know, we see a certain amount of gun violence take place. And, you know, I'd rather protect myself than wait for law enforcement. Not, I mean, again, I'm not
right.
law enforcement in New Jersey, but I mean, some residents might say, well, wait a minute, you know, who is law enforcement to sort of make that final decision? At the end of the day, how safe do I feel? Is that something maybe that, I don't want to say goes unchallenged, but is that something perhaps that you've heard of as a potential concern from people or residents?
I don't, from my perspective, from what I've read, from what I've heard at hearings, I would say the concern would be unfounded. When I say that law enforcement creates the debate on this particular issue, is that they've given situations have occurred, and no, I do not have them in front of me right this time, but there are situations that have occurred where somebody has had a handgun, and perhaps they had the handgun. Does everybody who, you know, it's one thing if, and I think, you know, we have to be cautious whether we're talking about have possessing as opposed to concealed carry.
Okay.
Were you talking about the concealed carry situation, that you wanted to be able to carry your handgun and also have it loaded and conceal it?
Well,
is that what you wanted
to
do?
Well, I mean that's what I'm sort of asking about, in the sense of, you know, I know here in New Jersey, gun laws, again, just to sort of bring up a correlation, I mean, gun laws are sort of perhaps the strictest in the country. And again, as you mentioned before, we all know that New Jersey is the most densely populated state in the country as it pertains to population, as you mentioned before. And certainly that is information that is readily available. One of the things that I sort of wanted to add to that narrative right now you mentioned was, again, because there isn't sort of a federal uniform standard, you know, we see other states that have very different gun laws, and their statistics are very different when it comes to, for example, how they deal with gun violence. I remember looking at the stats, I believe, in the state of Texas. And, you know, one of the things that seems to come up a lot in the data is the fact that, you know, gun violence is down. If not, maybe it's the lowest anywhere in the country. I don't know the exact ranking off the top of my head, but I know that gun deaths and gun violence, for example, in Texas don't take place anywhere near the rate that it takes place in other states. Like in Texas, for example, someone's going to think twice before committing a robbery because more likely residents are carrying a concealed carry permit. You know, gun ownership is sort of a cultural, you know, phenomenon in Texas. You know, people take their gun rights very seriously, and it's almost like a badge of honor, for example, for Texans, as opposed to other states. And we see that, for example, we see a very low amount of burglaries and robberies or assaults with a weapon, with a handgun. They're much lower. I don't want to say non-existent, they happen, but certainly at a much smaller rate than anywhere in the country. Is that more of just a sort of a social climate that permeates in states like Texas, or is it just altogether the way we educate about guns?
I'm going to look at this again from a public health perspective. And education is key. I think culture, gun culture itself, and yes, I've been to Texas several times, and to not only just San Antonio, but to the Western Panhandle and other places. within the state. So I certainly know that it varies also from cities to the more rural areas. But from a public health perspective, if we at least were collecting some data and looking at this dilemma, and it's a dilemma that would the carrying of guns in Texas, does it make, how does it change a person? Is the possibility of nonviolent discussion even deterred somehow from carrying a gun? I don't know if you are aware that right now the United States Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, is actually was prevented by Congress from researching gun violence and methods, possible solutions, once we had some data to solving it. There was a piece of legislation that would impact their funding if they research gun violence at all, and that law stands today. So we have our premier health organization that researches problems that we have in society, not even able to look at what are the fatalities, where is this occurring at, why is this happening? Let's look at the problems that you've mentioned. Situation that is somewhat ironic, but I think also multifaceted in Chicago, or the situation in Texas, in other rural states. How do we solve this nationally? How do we solve it on a local basis? Granted, many of the pieces of legislation that are moving here in New Jersey, and the same has happened with environmental legislation, that it often the toughest laws to clean up water, to clean up Superfund sites, all started on the state level first, and then New Jersey's been a leader on those. I don't look at this really as any different, but one of the differences is that the EPA was able to at least look at, collect data and have their scientists work on it and come up and to see if the solutions that the states were coming up with made any sense and should they be adopted on a nation, on a national level. So I would urge one of the answers to your question to be, let's at least get the CDC working on collecting data and looking at this from a public health perspective.
That makes sense. I'm with you on that. That makes sense. I can totally be on board with you on that. I think that will be important. I think as an academic, I'm all about data and statistics. The more data we can have, it's certainly much more advantageous for us to sort of address a problem. Dolores, one of the things that caught my eye about Ceasefire New Jersey, and again, for our listeners tonight that are not aware, I know that Ceasefire New Jersey is really sort of a, I don't want to say a smaller component, but, you know, it's relatively contained within sort of a much larger, more macro type of movement, and that's the Coalition for Peace Action. I know that that Ceasefire New Jersey is a product of. For our listeners tonight that aren't aware, could you tell us a little bit more about what got you interested in working for the Coalition for Peace Action, and, you know, really, what are some recent achievements that you can brag about as it pertains to what this nonprofit has been able to accomplish?
Well, you've asked two questions. I'm going to try and answer them quickly. I am a public interest lobbyist. not a contract lobbyist that works for a particular entity, but I actually have philosophies, morals, and ethics that I want to live by. So the work that I do is consistent with those ethics. That's number one. And primarily I come out of the animal rights movement, the environmental movement, renewable energy, toxic use reduction, solid waste reduction. So I've worked on all these issues rather significantly. In terms of the coalition itself, one of its most important roles is in its title, Peace Action in Peace. And if we look around, and I'd like to just add quickly that I had mentioned before that I was raised in a military family. Well, my father, who was career military, and I mentioned a World War II decorated combat veteran, Purple Heart, et cetera, raised us in a way where war was always a topic in the household. Not music, not art, you know, not literature, but war. And this was a family that watched combat on TV regularly and anything that glorified war, because I think my father might have found this one of the most exciting parts of his life. And what one of the aspects of the Coalition for Peace Action is reminding people that honestly, all of us want peace. We really don't want to be in war. We look at the countries that we're pouring significant amount of our federal budget into, where you know war is far removed from us right now, that we have to continue to educate. So they educate. The defense budget is worked on significantly, and the organization originally was started around no nuclear warfare, and it continues to work on this. So, and probably there's nothing more important than where we put our dollars in the federal budget, and it's one of the few organizations that works at this and looks at how those dollars in the Department of Defense are utilized.
Okay. Well, I mean, listen, that's a noble endeavor and cause in terms of how you just outlined it for us tonight, Dolores. And by the way, as folks, again, if you're just joining, it's about 20 minutes past the hour. You've been an absolute sweetheart tonight, Dolores. You've been on for about an hour. I know you had a long day. Just another moment of your time real quick. If you could let our listeners know any contact information for yourself or for Ceasefire or for the Coalition for Peace Action, I certainly would like our listeners to check out your organization. And certainly if they wish to get involved, you know, that's their prerogative to do that. And I certainly want to, you know, give you any promotions I possibly can. If you want to tell our listeners real quick any contact information or social media links.
Certainly, I would like to mention the website for the organization is peacecoalition.org.
Okay, and certainly I know that you're also on Twitter, right? I mean, not yourself personally, but the organization is as well, right? Ceasefire, I believe, is at CeasefireNJ on Twitter.
On Twitter, yes, and also on Facebook. I apologize, have the Twitter handle in front of me right now.
I'm looking at it right now. It's at CeasefireNJ. I haven't looked at the Peace
Thank
Coalition
you.
One person. Yeah, I haven't looked at it, but the Twitter feed for Ceasefire is at CeasefireNJ. So when you're on the website, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a chance, when you're looking at the website, definitely – for Peace Coalition, certainly it'll take you to their Facebook and, of course, to their Twitter account I just mentioned. Real quick, Delos, before I let you go, I always make it a point to give my guests, you know, their turn to, after I'm grilling you for an hour. And for the record, I think this was a very productive conversation today. I think it was very good. I think we had a really good, healthy dialogue today. Would you agree?
I absolutely agree. And I think this is the type of dialogue that we need to have on this issue. So I want to thank you.
Well, no, I'm glad. No, I want to thank you more for again, your valuable time. And certainly before I let you go real quick, again, as I say to every guest, you know, I grill my guests for an hour every week, and now it's your turn. The floor is yours. If you want to grill me or ask a question of me, the floor is yours.
Well, I would like to ask you a question. Did you get that handgun yet?
No, I have not. No, it's a really lengthy process here in New Jersey, so it has not happened. No, it has not happened. And
we will continue the discussion on justifiable need. I did want to ask you, where do you teach? I don't need to know exactly where you teach, but do you teach high school, or do you teach college, do you teach elementary school?
I'm a college professor up here in Hudson County. I teach in the Division of Social Sciences at my local community college here, and I teach primarily sociology courses, intro, gender and society, race in America. So, you know, I'm every bit the social scientist that you can think of when you think of an academic. So,
this is a perfect subject for your sociology class.
Oh, absolutely. And that's a great thing about teaching sociology is that you can rely on everyday society and issues and concepts and subject matter that affects us every day. You know, it's certainly a lot easier to teach when you can apply theoretical constructs to everyday living. So I'm really blessed. I have great students. I enjoy teaching at the collegiate level, and it's fulfilling, sure.
Well, I challenge you to bring your students down to the state legislature, have them experience what it is like and how policy is made, and to sit in on one of these hearings on the issue of gun violence. And it is a tremendous experience in understanding all facets of society.
Okay. Well, listen, I certainly want to do that. I think it'd be a good field trip for my students, maybe for some extra credit, to head down to Trenton and to do that. I'll certainly continue. And listen, you've been great tonight, and I really want to thank you for the good work you do. I'm sure that we can agree to disagree on some policy measures. But as you mentioned, I think it's important to have a civil and a cordial dialogue. I think that's what's important. And when it comes to anything involving government and legislation, I do want to thank you for the opportunity to come on tonight. I appreciate you supporting Politically Direct, and I hope you tell your friends online and on social media to really give us a chance here on Politically Direct and also with Insider NJ, because what I'm trying to do is something very different in terms of a podcast than anybody else in the state of New Jersey. And I'm really working hard every week to sort of be an innovator, because there aren't a lot of podcasts like this statewide. I know we have, you know, New Jersey 101.5 FM, which is sort of like, you know, like they're like the Yankees, and I'm like a AAA ball club right now. You know, I'm sort of like in the infancy stage, but.
Well, I would be more than happy to help promote this. And yes, I will let people know about not only the show tonight, but your other shows. And I did research on your website this new concept that you have developed. And I appreciate the questions were good, spot on. You did do your research. And we had a dialogue about some of the most volatile issues, and we were able to do it. I appreciate us being able to do this without calls coming in, because sometimes it's too hard. Well, not only is that staff intensive because you have to field everybody, but you have a set of questions, and so we're able to actually go through the questions. So you are like another Terry Gross.
Well, hey, I'm doing my best here, Dolores. And like I said, one of the things I take a lot of pride in is this is a very different type of podcast. Like I mentioned, I'm certainly not on the level of NJ 101.5 FM or a couple of other maybe online media sort of programs right now in New Jersey. But I rest assured that what I'm trying to do and partnering with Insider NJ is important because I know that their audience is growing at an astronomical rate. I want to make this podcast very different. I want to make it, again, and I'm speaking as an academic and as a teacher at the end of the day, I want to make this informative. Yes, I want to entertain to some point, but it's important to inform, to educate. And when we can talk about issues like this in a civil manner, it's crucial because we're not having a screaming match. We're not having, we're not talking over each other. This is dialogue. This is discourse. And this is something that is very much needed, not just in this arena when it comes to gun reform, gun rights, and looking, but I think in general. Yeah, I'm a political junkie, Dolores. I eat, sleep, and breathe politics. You know, my graduate degrees were in political science, so I live and breathe politics, both locally, statewide, and federally. So for me, it's important to have a dialogue, and I appreciate you contributing to that tonight, Ms. Phillips, and God bless you and your work that you do. Stay safe, and I look forward to having you back on later on in the summer, and we can catch up and maybe, you know, have a little bit of an update of what's going on in terms of how these bills are moving forward and what impact they're having here in New Jersey. Can you come back on the show?
Absolutely.
Wonderful. I appreciate your time. I know you've had a long day. Thank you for an hour of your time tonight, Dolores. And again, thank you for supporting Politically Direct. We'll talk to you soon. And by the way, have a happy Easter to you and your family. Enjoy. And hopefully this weather gets better here in New Jersey.
Thank you.
Have a great
night. Good night.
You too. Take care. Folks here, again, if you had a chance to listen in tonight, a great appearance by Ms. Dolores Phillips there from Ceasefire NJ as part of the Coalition for Peace Action. Again, you can check out their website, www.peacecoalition.org. A really, really productive episode tonight, folks, in terms of looking at the very controversial issues concerning gun rights in New Jersey, gun reform, you know, what makes for common sense gun laws. I know that that's come under some considerable debate, and we analyze that today with recent hearings down in Trenton with the state assembly. And certainly, a good guest on tonight, and I appreciate her time. And certainly it's one of those things, folks, that we can take a lot of pride in here on Politically Direct. And, really, it's as we're coming up at the bottom of the hour here, 30 minutes past 9 here on the East Coast, as we're about to wrap up here shortly, I'll tell you, it's one of those things, folks, that it's time flies when you're having a good episode, and that helps a lot when you have great guests. And that's something I'm very blessed with here each and every week. And again, don't forget that every Thursday night live at 8 p.m., you can always listen to the best analysis and commentary about everything going on in New Jersey and the political scene here. You can always listen to it on Politically Direct. Now, don't forget to check out Insider NJ every single day, ladies and gentlemen, by going to their website, www.insidernj.com. So again, for the best coverage of the political scene, what's going on in Trenton, what's going on in the governor's mansion, what's going on under the Golden Dome, in both chambers of legislature, and much more, what's going on each and every county throughout the Garden State. A lot of politics, a lot of political news to cover. No one does it better than Insider NJ. When you go to their website, again, sign up for their morning intelligence briefing. You can't go wrong, folks. Wake up, have your morning coffee, have your waffles, scrambled eggs, have your cereal, and you know what? Start your day with Insider NJ. And again, as I mentioned, if you missed any part of tonight's broadcast, you can always go to www.blogtalkradio.com/politicallydirectNJ, and you can do so from any PC, Mac, smartphone, or tablet. Now, if you have a topic or issue you want to hear about next week, please write to the show's inbox, folks, which is politicallydirectnj@yahoo.com. Again, don't forget to like the show on Facebook. We appreciate all the likes. We're almost at 300 in just a short amount of time. So, again, let's get those likes up there. Please share the page. I appreciate it. Again, I do want to thank my guest tonight, Dolores Phillips from Ceasefire NJ, a local nonprofit here in New Jersey. Again, they are part of the Coalition for Peace Action nonprofit group in Trenton. Here in the Garden State. So again, folks, and don't forget to follow the show on Instagram at Politically Direct NJ. You can also follow me on Instagram at your_favorite_Fernando. And I can't say enough, ladies and gentlemen, whether it's on your morning commute, getting that daily workout in, walking your dog, watching March Madness, and maybe it's halftime, you're looking at your bracket, you don't know what's going on, you want to figure out how you're doing in your March Madness pool, want to take a break, hey, check out the archives, and you'll be happy that you did. And don't forget, every single week here, courtesy of Insider NJ, it's real, it's here, it's politically direct. Good night. Carteret, New Jersey. Right off exit 10 there on the Jersey Turnpike there, one of the nicer towns here in the Garden State. I'll see you next week, folks, on Blog Talk Radio. And don't forget, let's keep on talking.